Well, let's look at mining in our country now. And Union Umku says its protected strike at Sibanye-Stillwater will continue until its demands of a 1,000 rand increment for the next 3-year period are met. Now, Sibanye-Stillwater currently employs about 32,200 people at its South African gold operations. A 3-year wage deal was accepted last year by two of the unions. That's the NUM, the National Union of Mine Workers, and Solidarity. But Umku says, nope, they've given it the thumbs down. However, Sibanye-Stillwater said that with more than 50% of its employees accepting the wage offer, it was therefore entitled to extend the wage offer to Umku members as well. And this has caused a little bit of consternation. So where does this leave the strike? And also, can Sibanye-Stillwater actually absorb the costs of lost production? We see strikes at mines, the mining community under pressure at the moment. It also comes as mining companies worry about irregular commodity prices and also shafts being mined out. On the line is Head of Economic Justice and also mining expert at Oxfam, Temenkosi Dlamini. Temenkosi, hi, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Good evening, Ray. Thanks for having us.
Temenkosi, can Sibanye still survive a continued loss of production like this? I mean, Umku, they are sort of digging in. They're saying, we've got 43% of a support base here. We're not going anywhere. I mean, where does this leave the mine?
Yes, I think it all depends on a number of factors. But with Sibanye at the current moment, we know that the company was busy with a number of core acquisitions in the previous period, which means at the current moment they are sort of heavy in debt, with a view to try in as much as possible to recoup from the sales of production so that they repay the debt. But at the current moment, given low levels of production at the back of the strike, we do think that it is going to have a very difficult time, unless, of course, the company was sitting on stockpiles of previous production that they set aside in anticipation of a rainy day such as this one.
Right. Okay, let's look at it from this angle. I mean, after the Marikana massacre a few years ago, the salaries of mine workers came into sharp focus. Did they improve after that? I mean, we were talking about that figure, I think, of 12,500 rand. Where do we sit now?
Well, I think there has been some significant improvement in the wage offers after the Marikana massacre. However, we were starting from a very low base, especially given a history of exploitative wages which were given to miners in South Africa in general, which has sort of put South Africa at this envied position of one of the greatest miners in the Southern Hemisphere, as it were. However, the salaries have improved. But we still have not reached at least the 12,500 that was being demanded at the back of the Marikana strike.
Yeah.
You know, so I think from AMCU point of view, they rose as an institution at the back of the demand for 12,500. I don't think they are going to back down until that day where they can achieve that. So miners need to demonstrate that they can progressively try to move towards that benchmark that has already been set.
Yeah. What they're living at now, I mean, is it livable? Can a family get by on what they are earning now?
Well, I think the mining wages are meager, as it were. And most of the families certainly cannot live on those wages. At the same time, there are issues such as mining companies deciding to give workers living out allowances in lieu of providing proper affordable accommodation. So the situation is such that miners, as it were, in South Africa, they still maintain two households, one back at home in Eastern Cape, Lesotho, or wherever, and then they probably live in a shack around the mining shaft where they work. So the situation is deplorable, and there needs to be adherence to the commitment in the mining charter and also the social and labor plans, which are a regulatory instrument that were put in place by the government to ensure that they address this history of exploitation in the mining industry going back so many hundreds of years.
Yeah. Where are we with the mining charts? I mean, there was great hoorah about it last year. After the exit of Mosabenzizwane as the minerals minister, there seemed to be some sort of agreement, or was there?
Yes, there was some sort of agreement from, of course, with the mining charter, the one that was adopted, of course. I mean, the issues of the mining charter is something that needs to be adjusted as we go with the time. And also taking into account the fact that the mining charter is not a binding instrument at the same level that a social and labor plan would, for instance, or a process where there is adequate taxation on mining companies that then goes to government coffers to be able to deliver public services. At the same time, the question of the mining charter, government is slow in terms of putting in place the mechanisms such as how communities are going to decide on putting up a trust where they can, you know, locate their own shareholding, and also setting out timelines to say when are mining companies expected to comply with the legislation and how. Because what we don't want to see is a situation where the BEE shares that are meant for communities, they are still grabbed by the powerful and connected elites in these communities to the detriment of the poor in these communities.
Just leading on to that, I mean, looking at the viability of the country's mines, we also don't want people to inherit mines that are mined out. Where are we looking with our gold and our other minerals as well? I mean, how healthy is the sustainability of the mining industry?
I think we are quickly realizing that mining is not the sunrise sort of a driver of the economy that is expected to be. We also missed the opportunities in the past, such as establishing the sort of backward and forward linkages that are necessary to ensure that we do not mine our output and export it as raw material, but rather ensure that we mine what is linked to our food production, what is linked to our tertiary industries, so that we sort of beneficiate within South Africa and we develop this sort of secondary and tertiary industry that will keep the economy afloat at the sunset of mining.
Yeah.
But we have missed that opportunity because of the way that our regulation and legislation around mining was put out.
Why haven't we ever sort of aimed, like you said, concentrated on beneficiation? Why has it always been about just getting that raw product out and that's the end of the story? It just doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense if you consider that South Africa is one of the countries that are very rich when it comes to mineral resources, and also the capability that is there in terms of a strong financial sector, in terms of a strong government. But I think at the back of this was the question of lack of political will in terms of putting in place policies that will ensure that mining houses benefit more, or they have that sort of incentives to beneficiate the minerals in South Africa instead of exporting them as primary commodities, as it were.
Yeah.
So it is more of a policy failure, more than anything, a leadership failure, to the extent that there was never any political will to develop, to put in place the infrastructure that is necessary to transition in that direction.
But surely the Minerals Minister is now looking at that now. We're looking at creating jobs, and this is one massive way to create jobs and maybe move away from traditional mining into something else.
Well, at the current moment, given the fact that the minister is failing to manage even simple things such as observing the rights of communities to say no to mining, such as is the case with the Amadida Crisis Committee in Tolobeni, and also numerous other communities who are evicted of the land at the back of mining licenses that have already been issued without proper consultation. We do not think that the DMR has got the capability to help this economic transition in the ways that are desired towards tertiary industries. Even when it comes to the regulatory muscle of the DMR, in most communities where the communities expect the companies to implement the social and labor plan in terms of human resource development, in terms of fiscal provision, the people feel that the DMR is an absent actor.
Right.
Without any capacity whatsoever to regulate the sector.
Well, that doesn't sound good whatsoever. It really doesn't, because it also leads me to my next question. And tonight on The Money Show, talking about jobs. In fact, a little bit later on, we'll be talking about youth unemployment. The question of mechanization of mines. Many mining companies are looking at this. They're going towards mechanization, and that means jobs will be lost.
Yes, certainly. Without any proper regulation to encourage intensive, labor-absorptive ways of mining in South Africa, it means mining companies will increasingly be looking towards mechanization, because with mechanization, at least they know they can access the appropriate financial outlays to invest in those capital expenditures, and after that, it's all systems go, most of the things are fixed without any sort of work stoppages because of strikes. But if you look at the current scenario where things like electricity are already constituting about 10% of the operational expenses of mines, the energy question that we are avoiding in South Africa, it means there's also uncertainty when it comes to that area to say when they have access to the appropriate energy sources to drive these mechanized mining operations.
Yeah, that is a bit of a problem facing all of us. Just a final question. I mean, looking at black ownership, traditional mining houses, how prepared are they to hand over to black ownership to maybe promote transformation in our country?
Well, the question of transformation will not happen without some form of strong regulation coming from DMR point of view. What we have seen in the past, even the commissioner responsible for broad-based black economic empowerment coming in to say there's a lot of fronting that is happening within mining communities where simply black people are used as fronts for white people and white companies to own certain shares, but also the question of some other practices that are happening within these mining houses, where without the carry interest that has been introduced in the current mining charter, in the past the mining house would go out there to look for debt on behalf of the PE entity. So they wouldn't know how much debt or what the debt was used for. So what would happen is that these people would be holding on to BEE shares with a lot of debt. So whatever profit that is being made is quickly taken away by the mining company back to a sister company offshore, where it is said that it is paying this debt, when in effect it's a repatriation of profits in a way.
Sure.
So there isn't much in as far as black people who have benefited from broad-based black economic empowerment or even community ownership trusts that have benefited. And then there's also the question of the lack of mechanisms, for instance, to ensure that communities benefit whenever this money is then put out by mining companies because of the lack of the sort of mechanisms to make sure that the communities can utilize the money. A good case is the Anglo-American Makgalagwena mine, where over $175 million has been sitting in a lawyer's account without being utilized because there is no agreement or government institution that is coming in to say, this is how you need to organize yourselves as a community.
Yeah.
In order to benefit from this money that has been set aside.
Sounds like massive failure all around. Temban Kosi Dlamini, Head of Economic Justice and Mining at Oxfam, thank you so much for putting things into perspective on The Money Show.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.